I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics Podcast. The international scene is more uncertain and threatening than for a very long time. Tensions with North Korea have escalated dramatically, so the end point has now become quite unpredictable. We are yet to see how Donald Trump's defence and foreign policy generally will play out in both our region and more widely. Next week in New York, Malcolm Turnbull will meet the President for their first face-to-face discussion. Today we're joined by Peter Jennings, the Executive Director of the think tank ASPI, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, to talk about these issues. Peter Jennings, let's start with Korea. How close do you think we are to the possibility of armed conflict?
Michelle, I don't think we're going to see armed conflict anytime this year, because I think the US has now resolved that it's going to exhaust all diplomatic options first before it thinks about preemptively striking at the North's missiles and nuclear facilities. And really what that means is one more try to see if the Chinese are prepared to apply the type of sanctions that would hurt North Korea sufficiently to make it want to give up its weapons programs. I think that's probably going to play out over the course of 2017. But of course, we don't know how the North is going to react to that. One response may well be to speed up its weapons programs rather than to actually get rid of them. And so the prospect of conflict, I think, is one which is going to become much more realistic as we move into 2018.
How much influence do the Chinese have with the North Koreans?
Well, they're the North's single most important economic and energy lifeline. So all of the North's oil and coal comes into North Korea from China by rail. And indeed, most of the North's, what remains of its legitimate exports and its imports from China comes through the same way. So China controls their economic lifeline. But the one thing that we can say with some certainty about the North is that they have spent literally 25 years on a quest to develop a nuclear weapons program and an associated missile delivery program. And I frankly don't think that China's authority with North Korea runs to the extent of making them give that up. I think they will do that at the cost even of the relationship with China.
So really, China's dealing with a regime that's to some extent not a rational regime in terms of international policy. Is that a fair enough comment?
It sort of has the rationality of extreme survival, I suppose, is how I would describe it. I think the North has concluded. It's looked at Libya, it's looked at Iraq under Saddam Hussein, and it's concluded that the only real guarantee of its survival is not the goodwill of China. It's about whether or not they can develop their own nuclear weapon and the ability to deliver it to the United States.
But that's an irrational conclusion, surely.
There's a certain sort of rat-like logic that applies to it, and I think is something that only works within the sort of dynamic of a society which has been fooled by its own propaganda for since really the Korean War. It's not crazy insane. There's a consistency to it. But it's certainly not how normal countries behave in the international environment.
There's a dreadful dilemma here, isn't there, for the United States and other countries observing this situation. On the one hand, you could argue that military action early on would be desirable in the sense that it would stop North Korea becoming an even more of a threat, although that military action would come with an enormous cost for South Korea and neighbouring countries. But the other side is if nothing is done and North Korea develops its weapons to a state of being able to hit the United States, hit Australia and other distant countries, then you're in a worse situation.
Yes, I think that is pretty much the calculation that the United States is now considering. You could have said up until maybe 18 months ago that the North's program was going nowhere fast. As I said, it had been working on a nuclear program for the better part of 25 years. But in the last 18 months, what we've seen is a significant acceleration of the North's nuclear testing, which is all about refining a bomb and then miniaturizing it to the extent that it can fit into the nose cone of a missile. And at the same time as they've been doing that, they've been expanding the range of different types of missiles that they have, land systems that are mobile, missiles that can be launched from submarines. So I think the different calculation the Americans have to factor in is that the North is getting close, and it now sees itself within a decent sprint of being able to weaponize a missile that could hit Los Angeles.
How long will that take, do you think?
Well, there's public comment that American officials with CIA backgrounds have said possibly as much as 4 years. I think it's faster than that. I think you could perhaps even halve that, because you've got to factor in the much more rapid tempo of testing that the North is going through. So maybe in as little as 2 years, that intercontinental ballistic missile with a nuclear weapon will be a reality.
And what about Australia? How long before it could hit Australia?
Pretty much the same time frame. It could, if a missile is able to hit the west coast of the United States, then it would certainly be able to hit targets on the Australian east coast. So roughly the same time frame.
What do you make of the quite bellicose comments coming from North Korea about Australia? Do you think this is just throwing out a bit of propaganda?
Well, it certainly is that, and the North has always done a line of the most unbelievably inflammatory propaganda. They're really masters at it. It's unusual to see us in the crosshairs of that type of language, and I think it just reflects, though, as with most propaganda, it's designed really for domestic consumption, and this is all about sustaining the support of the population of North Korea for this nuclear effort.
You'd wonder that they would have even heard of Australia, let alone Julie Bishop's comments.
One of the things I've observed about them is that they actually follow these things pretty closely, particularly as it relates to
the regime, their interests. The local population.
Oh, indeed. And I think mostly what that was really directed to was the fact that Australia was the next port of call for Vice President Pence after his visit to Seoul. So I wouldn't necessarily read too much by way of a realistic threat to Australia from those comments, but nevertheless, it's just a matter of physical reality that if they can hit the US, they'll certainly be able to hit us.
Now, turning to the Middle East, how much progress is being made against Islamic State?
I think there's been good progress in the 6 months or so since we last spoke, Michelle. There's now really the remnants of the Islamic State in the western part of the city of Mosul in Iraq are being wiped up. It's a very ugly street-to-street fight, because a lot of the people who are left are intent on going to their own deaths. They're mostly the foreign element of the Islamic State. They can't sort of melt back into the Iraqi population, and they're sufficiently battle-hardened that they will go down fighting. So this is tough, but I think the momentum is now all in favour of the Iraqi armed forces and their various supporters. And that will still leave quite a lot of the Islamic State to deal with in parts of central Iraq. But what we're talking about here is less of the almost conventional military that it turned into during a lot of 2016, and a return to more of the traditional style terrorist attacks, car bombs and those types of devices.
Do you think Australia will be asked for more military help there?
I think it's very likely that we will be asked for more help. Prime Minister Turnbull seems to have indicated that he sees our interests in Iraq as involving a long-term military commitment.
He's emphasised training, though, both there and in Afghanistan.
Yes, he has. And look, on that point, I think it's always the case that the Americans might want their allies to do more. And if they were to ask Australia to do more, the sorts of things that I imagine we would be thinking about would be integrating a team of our special forces in with the Americans It really then comes down to, so what's the appetite of our government to take on that type of role? Because clearly that's more risky to those who involved.
What about moving the people who are involved in airstrikes forward? I gather that they operate remotely at the moment.
Yes, although that's becoming...
Calling in airstrikes, that is.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we've seen in Mosul is that there are clearly people on the ground, not necessarily Australians, but there are now Western US forces accompanying the Iraqis who are able to direct airstrikes much more precisely than was the case. And in Syria, there's no doubt that American special forces, particularly with the Kurds, are right up at the front in terms of fighting Islamic State around Raqqa. At the moment, Australian policy remains that we stay on our bases. We don't go forward with the people that we've been training. And thus far, that, you know, it has to be said, it seems to have worked.
Do you think that Australian military forces in one role or another will be involved in these places for, say, the next 20 years?
Well, we've certainly been there for the last 20, so I think the next 20 it's going to take that long before we would say that the Middle East looks like it's approaching a more stable dispensation. And yes, I think we will be there. I think we've also learned a lesson from the haste with which Barack Obama withdrew the American military from Iraq in 2011. And really the message is, once you've sort of broken the glass and you're in, you have to be prepared to stay if you're serious about making lasting change.
Now, the Prime Minister talks to President Trump next week. If you were advising him, what would you be telling him to say and what would you be telling him to ask?
Well, the first thing I'd say is, Prime Minister, you're in a reasonably strong position when it comes to talking about the alliance relationship with the US, because we're meeting two of the most important American tests about whether their allies are serious or not. And the first of those tests is that we're on track in 2021 to be spending 2% of our gross national product on defence. And the second, as we've been talking about, is that we are making a genuine and valuable commitment to military operations in the Middle East. So my first piece of advice to the PM would be to say, you've got nothing to be embarrassed about. We're actually an ally in good standing. The next piece of advice would be to say, but don't wait for President Trump to come to you with a list of things he'd like Australia to do. I think we would always be in a much better situation if we could go to the Americans and say, now here are the things we want to do that will strengthen our alliance. And maybe there'll be an opportunity for Mr. Turnbull to kind of take that approach in his meeting in New York.
And what would those things be?
Well, I would like to see us go back to the original time frame for getting that full deployment of 2,500 US Marines into the Northern Territory. That was originally set for 2016. It's now said to be pushed some years into the future.
Why is that?
Because we got ourselves into, I think, useless negotiation over the split of costs for the facilities. It took years and years, and finally we ended up in a situation where the government kind of intervened and said, okay, we'll just do 50-50 in terms of the cost split. This is building a small amount of buildings in Darwin and at the Air Force Base near Katherine. With that resolved, I think what we should do is push on to get the full deployment of the Marines quickly, because I think that would be a very strong signal of America's commitment to the security of the Asia Pacific. That would be my first suggestion. And then I think on Korea, you know, rather than waiting for an American request to say, well, Australia, will you do something with us in Korea? I'd be saying to the president, look, we need to know what your planning is. You know, we need to understand what your thinking is about military contingencies in order for us to know if it's sensible for us to be involved. You know, at this stage, I think another lesson from the Iraq experience is that there should be no representation without actually being part of the planning. And so that would be my counter to any request from President Trump, would be to say, well, let us know what your thinking is first.
On Korea, though, what sort of role could we have?
Frankly, if the Americans were thinking about a preemptive strike to destroy the North Korean missile and nuclear infrastructure, there's not much that we could do. We could perhaps assist them with a bit of collaboration on intelligence. We could maybe be there with some support for after the sort of strike event itself, but we're not really in a place where we could do much that could be done as quickly as the Americans would need to in order to destroy those nuclear facilities.
Can we just talk lastly about your takeout of the Trump presidency? Do you think it is getting somewhat more settled than seemed the case initially, or do you think it is still really very much up in the air where he'll go on various issues?
I think he's had a rough first 100 days. I really don't recall an administration that's had so much sort of internal lack of clarity around key policy areas. But, you know, I think Trump has made good progress in his relations with key allies, the Japanese and the British. I think he's come to some degree of understanding with China's President Xi Jinping about how to squeeze North Korea, which is a positive. And I think we see the sort of military professionals of the administration, like General Mattis and General McMaster and the National Security Council, starting to exert, you know, more significant authority, which the president is listening to on defense and international security issues. The one area which I think is uncertain still is really about where the real centres of power reside in the White House. Increasingly, it looks like it's more with the family than any of the individuals that were with the president during the election campaign. And that's still a vulnerability, I think, for him long-term in terms of his position domestically with regard to Congress. To sum up, I guess, yes, I think we are seeing signs of the administration stabilising, becoming a bit more normal as a Republican administration, but there's still some challenges around the role of Trump and in particular his family, I think, as his key advisors in the White House.
Peter Jennings, thank you very much for talking with The Conversation today. That's all for our podcast. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins. We'll be back again soon. Goodbye for now.